from the 18th, according to the rules, everybody going into one of these matches at either Rangers, Celtic, Aberdeen, Hearts, Hibs, or any match that crosses 10,000 people will have to be checked.
That was Sean Hamilton, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello, and welcome to the Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malick, and on this episode, I'll be joined by Andy Phillip, Adele Merson, and special guest, Courier Sport editor Sean Hamilton, to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
Refuse workers have threatened to go on strike during COP26 over a pay dispute. Members of the GMB union in Glasgow have voted in favour of industrial action during the climate summit, which is expected to draw about 30,000 people to the city. It follows news ScotRail workers also plan industrial action during the event, which could have a severe impact on how delegates and attendees visit the gathering. The suspect in a bow and arrow attack that killed 5 people and wounded 3 others in the quiet Norwegian town of Kongsberg this week is facing a custody hearing. Espen Andersen Brathen will not appear in court because he has confessed to the killings and has agreed to being held in custody, officials said. The 37-year-old Danish citizen was arrested on Wednesday night, 30 minutes after a deadly rampage which apparently targeted random people. Police have described the attack as an act of terror. MPs are to examine next week whether public money committed to considering a UK and Ireland bid to host the 2030 World Cup represents good value for the taxpayer. The Cross-Party Digital, Culture, Media and Sport Committee will question funding body UK Sport on Tuesday about the £2.8 million of government money allocated to a feasibility study on whether to bid for the tournament.
Thank you, Morag. Right, it's been a busy old week in politics, despite our representatives being on yet another recess. But first, it seems that the never-ending confusion around vaccine passports has cropped up again, this time afflicting our national team. There was a bit of a queue as Scotland kicked off against Israel in that nail-biting World Cup qualifier last Saturday, which the Scottish Conservatives claimed was because of COVID passport checks. We now know that this isn't the case, and regular visitors to the National Stadium were quick to point out that things like queues and missed kickoffs happen all the time. Sean, what have our local teams been saying about vaccine passport checks ahead of the return of league football this weekend? And will fans be expected to prove that they've been double vaccinated before they get in?
Our local teams have been saying very little indeed about vaccine passports, for the reason that fans in our part of the world will not be expected to show their vaccination status before matches in this part of the country. The reason for that being, quite simply, that the capacities that are likely to be reached don't cross the threshold for that requirement. In football terms, really, it's the rule is any event over 10,000, which is a seated outdoor event, given the wording of the rules. Now, top flight Scottish football are seated events. So by definition, people going to them don't have to show their status until the capacity passes 10,000. And really, that means the implications in Scottish football are going to be largely limited to 5 teams in the Premiership, those being Rangers, Celtic, Hearts, Hibs and Aberdeen. Now, all of those teams have more than 10,000 season ticket holders. So by definition, they'll pass that threshold for every home league game. So the implications are big for those teams, but for ours, not so much. There's likely to be a need for some sort of plan around Dundee derbies. The first one of these coming up from now isn't until January the 2nd, so they've got a bit of time to see how it all shakes out with the other clubs between now and then and put a plan in place. But as I say, the implications are sort of going to be felt by other clubs in other parts of the country rather than ours specifically.
And what about when, you know, teams like Rangers or Celtic come through to Perth and Dundee, yep, or even Aberdeen, you know, if they are not getting 10,000 in, will the rules change around that, do we know? Or is that something that they'll just have to cross when it comes to that?
Yeah, I mean, if events are ticketed rather than pay at the gate these days, so the likelihood is that Celtic coming to, let's say, Dundee or Dundee United, I think Celtic are at United in December, start of December, so that has potential, certainly, to cross that 10,000 threshold. And if it does, indeed, the legislation dictates that Dundee United will have to have a plan in place to check people who are going into the stadium. And I believe that legislation says that everybody has to be checked. So, as I say, they've got a bit of time to see what happens at these other stadiums where it's going to be required on a weekly basis, if you like. And obviously, the enforcement starts on the 18th of October after what was called a grace period, I believe, given the problems that they had with the NHS Scotland COVID status app. So from the 18th, according to the rules, everybody going into one of these matches at either Rangers, Celtic, Aberdeen, Hearts, Hibs, or any match that crosses 10,000 people will have to be checked. So quite clearly there are some practical issues that might cause problems there.
We saw on Scotland's game on Saturday against Israel, there were queues. People were tweeting about the queues, and I know the Scottish Conservatives were quick to jump on the idea that it was COVID passports for that. There is an old ticket and entry system at Hampden, isn't there? But at Tannadice or Dens or McDermott Park, it's the old-fashioned turnstiles that you still use to get in, isn't it?
Yes. From direct experience at McDermott Park, because I'm a season ticket holder at St Johnstone, actually. So they are old-fashioned turnstiles. At St Johnstone, they are still staffed, but they do use barcode scanners, so in theory, they could be automated. They just haven't got around to doing that yet, spending the money to do it. At other grounds, that there are automated entry systems. So turnstiles aren't staffed. That's certainly the case at Hampden, which possibly may account for some of the delays we saw at the Israel game. But as anybody who's attended a match at Hampden as a supporter can tell you, if you leave your entry until sort of 10 minutes before kickoff, as a lot of people do, because there's obviously people like to get that last pint in before they go into the match, because obviously they can't get any more there, and drinking is a part of football attendance culture, that there is always a rush to get in at the last minute. So queues are not unusual at Hampden. And indeed, I think the problems at Hampden, I'm told, were related to this automated entry system and problems with the technology. Not related to checking vaccine status, but actually getting people through the turnstiles was the issue. But again, that's not unusual for matches at Hampden. Forgotten what your question was, Paul. I'm just waffling.
No, sorry. I was just basically pointing out that the turnstiles are going to be an issue, because yes. I know when I've queued up to get into Tannadice or Dens, you know, it takes a wee while longer. Also, the turnstiles are quite narrow. I'd just like to point that out as a broad-shouldered man that I often fear getting stuck, and that would just be it's actually a recurring nightmare of mine, getting stuck at the turnstile, the George Fox at Tannadice. But anyway, less of that. Adele, you pointed out, You flagged this story up when Aberdeen announced that they weren't actually going to be enforcing any of the rules. This was before the grace period was announced. Is this just another example of a programme that's been rushed out and hasn't been that well thought through of, and it's just a confusing state of affairs?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I think it's probably the first time I've ever had an exclusive sports story ever, was that Aberdeen was probably the first, if not one of the first, to sort of raise issues with the COVID passports. They went down a slightly different tact in saying that they had sort of had a huge number of fans come forward to say that they wouldn't want to sort of keep their season tickets if people were insisting that they have to show proof of vaccination on sort of ethical grounds, was more what they were suggesting. They could lose up to 1.5 million. They have said the majority of their fans have sort of answered a survey and said that they are double vaccinated, but just sort of on principle, they weren't happy with the idea of asking for the certification. But I guess it's happening now in a few days. I know last week, I think they had their game against Celtic, and they were going to trial it there, but with all the problems that people have been having with the app, they decided that everyone would be admitted regardless of whether they had proof or not. So I think it is going to be very interesting how that kind of, whether they actually managed to make that go smoothly in the next, I can't tell you when their next game is, but whatever their next game is.
And Andy, from a slightly different perspective, if you need 10,000, if a football game which is regarded as a seated event with 10,000 people needs a passport check, but fewer than 10,000 doesn't, yet in a nightclub you've got a lot less than 10,000 people, or at a gig, you've got a lot less than 10,000 people, but you might be asked to show proof of vaccine passport. Is that fair? And is there a bit of a disparity, do you think? And do you think people get a bit annoyed at that?
Yeah, the further into the sort of route out of the pandemic, the more these kind of glaring inconsistencies or just practical problems that don't appear to make much sense to perhaps the public start to really, you know, come forward. People have been tying themselves in knots trying to explain why one thing is possible, why one thing is not. I mean, just look at the COVID passport idea for getting into some places. So yeah, you could go into a pub which is packed without showing anything, and then you've got to show something to get into the football later. Then you can go out to a busy restaurant and that's fine. And then, you know, you could go to a nightclub but show a passport. You know, and then look at other things that we've been doing from day to day, weddings or anything like that. Gigs. I went to a gig which was inside a building and it was full of people. Hardly anybody was wearing a mask. And this is why we're having a big conversation about, you know, not having to show a negative test, but having to show a passport, which hadn't come in at that point. So yeah, it's no wonder that people probably just think, what's going on here? And is it even, it all, throughout the pandemic, a lot of the political side of things has been down to sort of buy-in, you know, goodwill from the public thinking, right, we'll all do this. But as soon as one thing changes and one thing doesn't, more and more and more, you can see people sort of thinking, do I really need to go along with this anymore? And that's when it all starts to become quite difficult and perhaps even a bit dangerous when you're talking about, you know, a public health emergency like this.
And Sean, are football fans, are they wearing masks when they're going to the stadium, or is that I know it's not a requirement that they do, but are you seeing a lot of masks when you're at games?
No, in my experience, not. There are still people who will wear them, and I include myself in that, when they're walking around the sort of internal areas of the stadium, if you like, or going to get food or going to the toilet or what have you, in transit, basically, within the stadium. But when you sit down in your seat, nobody really, in my experience, is wearing them. There might be one or two, but certainly probably 9 out of 10 or not, I would say. And that's probably, if not 9 out of 10, certainly 7 out of 10. Probably aren't while walking around, yeah, as well. So it's certainly starting to slip. It's quite apparent in a football environment that use of masks is not something a lot of people are conscious of in the same way that perhaps they are in shops or something like that. Because I think you still see more people adhering to that when they're walking about in shops, certainly than football. Football's getting a bit lax, I would say.
Yeah, and is that confusing environment as well, really, where you're inside, outside, depending on where you sit.
Yeah, it's true.
Which I suppose, I guess this all comes down to just mixed messaging that we're getting, and it seems to change every other week. It's provided us with plenty of material, so, you know, as long as that still happens, then I guess we can't as podcast makers and journalists can't complain too much. But I'm sure this won't be the last that we'll be talking on vaccine passports. It seems to have cropped up week in, week out. Now, moving on, a row erupted and has been slow burning, but sort of came to a head this week after the UK Justice Secretary, former Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, that's him off of Misogyny Works Both Ways chat, and Liz Truss, the new Foreign Secretary, the woman who replaced him in the role, had a fight over a big grace and favour mansion known as Chevening House. Now, I did Google it, and it is Chevening, not Chevening. The Foreign Secretary traditionally gets this house as a place where he can entertain, or she can entertain, diplomats and guests. Dominic Raab, when he was sacked as Foreign Secretary and put to justice, he was given the title of Deputy Prime Minister, a title that the Conservatives don't normally use. So this issue reared its head. We had Truss and Raab fighting over use of a mansion. I'm sure the people waiting in food banks and deciding whether or not to go back to work with a positive coronavirus test can feel sympathy for that. We know that the decision wasn't fixed until Boris Johnson, who is in Marbella at another mansion, decided to wield the sword of Damocles and say, you can share the house. I don't think he's going to split it in half, but this is really one of those stories that you couldn't really script, Andy, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you add in Boris Johnson's kind of choice language about fripperies and foibles, and you just think, what's going on here? It's almost like that story didn't quite break out of all the other kind of bits of chaos that were floating about when it was happening. I mean, there was already a reshuffle, and then there was, you know, attention obviously on what the reshuffle meant, but the fact that this kind of thing is going on in the background and then becomes a story in itself just sort of makes you wonder who's steering the boat. So yeah, there's 115 rooms in this house apparently, which you know, you could probably fit the whole government in there and not notice. So the fact that they're having a row about this, it does make you wonder where priorities are, or even if they are trying their hardest to make the best of a bad thing, no one looking at this could possibly think that's a government who has got its eye on the ball, surely.
And yet the latest polls show that the Tories are still miles ahead of Labour. It's just one of those stories where we get all excited because as political reporters, it seems like something that we can really bite our teeth into, but the public don't care. Or have the public become so anaesthetised to Boris Johnson's government and the way that he behaves and the way that the rest of his cabinet behaves that they've stopped caring?
Yeah, I think you could probably write, somebody could write a thesis on why the government's able to do so many questionable things and nobody seems to bat an eyelid. I don't know if people have just, yeah, as you say, they've just become immune to it now, that they almost, it doesn't create much a reaction. But yeah, I could only speak for myself that it's not a good look, is it? Like rowing about a mansion in the midst of the various crises that are going on, with its fuel, energy cuts, universal credit, it just looks a bit like Dominic Raab's letting his ego kind of, you know, he's lost his job and now he's wanting to make sure he, in the divorce settlement, he gets like this nice house. It's just, yeah, it's pretty embarrassing, really.
It is pretty ridiculous, but Dominic Raab is a man who's failed upwards, I think it's fair to say. He oversaw the evacuation of troops and personnel from Afghanistan from a beach in Crete. A very nice beach in Crete, I should say. I walked past it when I was on holiday. I didn't realise how close to that super posh hotel we were as we were walking until we saw the guards approach us and turned us away and said, "You can't come on this beach, it's private." The sea did look open at the time. I don't know, that's something that he said. That wasn't the case. And then other things, you know, we had his comments as Justice Secretary, I think it was just last week, where he said that misogyny flows both ways, which we know is just absolute nonsense. Sean, hopefully you don't live in the same political bubble that we do, which means that you can have a bit of sort of insight into how this will, you know, play out. How does it look from the outside where you have two of the supposedly top politicians in the UK arguing over a 115-bed mansion when there are no petrol in the pumps and no food on the shelves?
Well, first of all, as far as working from a beach in Crete goes, I won't hear a word said against remote working, Paul. I'm all for that. I think we should maintain our...
Are you in Crete right now?
Yes. I may be or I may not be, Andy. Frankly, none of your business. In terms of the actual stuff, I mean, I've gone from thinking that the Tories are Teflon and thinking that their sort of nefariousness is actually a positive for them. It seems to be attracting people. It's absolutely bizarre at the moment. It's like all of the horrors that they perpetrate seem to be, they get stronger. It's unbelievable. I don't know how this is happening. This is absolutely incredible to me. And I mean, an argument about a mansion is just, it's almost, it's grotesque for obvious reasons, but at the same time, it's kind of just like a piece of happy frippery now at this point, such as the depth of their horror show that that is their administration, that we can sit and laugh about an argument about a mansion. It's crazy.
Maybe that's it. It's just a sidetracking sort of thing where we can look at something that's a bit of escapism, and it doesn't, you know, people maybe floating above it all, forgetting that actually this is all happening right now here, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, there was an argument during the pandemic when it was at its height where we were still trying to, pre-vaccines and things, where we're looking at polls and sort of polling experts talking about how people naturally kind of cleave to the party of government just because they're the ones that are leading. They're the ones that are providing all the answers there, you know, so you stick to them. So it's almost like the opposition have no hope there. But the more we come out of it, it's still here, whether it's the SNP or whether it's the Conservatives in Scotland or the UK in general. People still appear to be sticking with Labour as the main opposition. They don't appear to be making any headway south of the border. And up here, it's the same kind of story. The SNP are still really, really, really holding on to the polling support. So one thing that maybe was signalled this week was the first report from MPs into the way that the pandemic's been handled. I don't know if that perhaps is a little flag now, just showing, well, actually, this is going to be a big deal. And going down the line, both governments are going to have some pretty tough things to have to go over again when we come to a state where we can talk about what was done rather than what we're doing. So I think that's when things could change, or we'll find out whether people really are happy with what they have.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how much of an impact that does have as you point out, the SNP government up here as well, because decisions that were made did seem to almost echo or be quite similar to the rest of the UK position, understandably so, as we were in the early days of the pandemic, because we just didn't know what was happening. But as things seemed to pan out, decisions were made or weren't made that seemed to have grossly affected our outcomes. You mentioned earlier about sort of escapism from this all, Andy. We should note that the Prime Minister says he is working from his holiday mansion in Marbella, and it does look, from some of the swimming photos we've seen, he does look like he has followed his no carbs before Marbs mantra, which, you know, he deserves a holiday. It's apparently only been 35 days since his last holiday, which was, that's even more time than between the holidays I take. Do we feel that politicians are, you know, we're in another recess, Westminster's in recess, Holyrood's in recess, and we know that the cabinet are working. We heard Graham Day on another radio show this morning saying he doesn't know why. This is Transport Minister Graham Day, I should say. He doesn't know why ScotRail are going to strike during COP26, even though it seems everyone else does. But do we feel that politicians get too much time off? Is this something that the public are aware of, or that there's another recess, Adele? And do you personally think that, you know, they should be spending a bit more time at the coalface?
Well, I certainly don't think the Marbella holiday is really a good time or move. But aside from that, I'm actually going to say that I don't think they get too many holidays, which is maybe controversial. I think it's easy for the public to say, I guess, that they get too much holidays, but I think we get a sense, being journalists up close, of how, and this is the line that they do like to give us, that when they're on holiday, they're actually up in the back in the constituencies doing constituency work. But I personally don't doubt that even reporting on politics is so busy that I can absolutely believe that politicians are kind of constantly on duty and constantly having to reply to constituents, as they should, because that's who's voted them in. But no, I don't actually think that they do get too much holidays when you consider how much kind of extra work and meetings and weekends that they do as well.
See, in the spirit of what Adele just said, there is a bit of a, you do detect sort of like this, Parliament must be recalled, how dare you be away, get back to the office kind of thing, about anything. And the opposition, to whoever is in power at that point, are you know, they always do it, and they always say you shouldn't be turning your back for 5 seconds. But people burn out, and if you want to have people making good decisions, then it's probably a good idea not to have them completely strung out all the time in the public eye. But, you know, you can see who the ones are that take advantage of that or not. But yeah, I mean, there can be a little bit of a hang 'em, flog 'em approach, I think, sometimes to politicians having a break. I mean, especially in the past couple of years, it's been tough for everybody. And, you know, if you can't have a long weekend somewhere at some point, then what can you do? Can I have a holiday now?
You're the boss, Andy.
I think it probably feeds into this narrative around politicians in general being on the take, if you like. Now, clearly they're not all like that, but there is a narrative that exists around it. And I think when the general public repeatedly see politicians voting to give themselves pay rises, and when you think about expenses and all that stuff, and then you throw holidays into the mix, I think it just, it becomes a bit of a poisonous brew. And there probably is, I don't know whether jealousy would be the right word to use, because that would hint that people want to be on the take themselves. So maybe that's not right, but there certainly is a sense that I think people feel they're being played by politicians at times. And I think that probably, the holidays issue feeds into that. And that's probably why it causes so much of an issue for people.
Yeah, and you touched on tiredness and earlier. I noticed this week there's been a fair few articles and pieces and suggestions that Nicola Sturgeon is looking tired, or she's, you know, she's looking like she's been very busy, or she's looking aged. And where we have a prime minister who often looks like he's been out on a 3-day bender, those sort of statements don't get made quite as much. I'm noticing one big difference between the two really is that one happens to be a woman. Are people genuinely worried, or do you think this is a sort of sexist or misogynistic language that often follows the first minister around, you know, that she looks tired, or she looks fed up, whereas Boris Johnson often gets let off the hook? Adele, what do you think about that?
If we're talking just widely, yeah, absolutely, women are held to a completely different standard than male politicians. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to argue that. It's, you look at, you know, a woman wears her shoulder was once out in the House of Commons, it turned into a big thing, or somebody has a certain type of high heels on. I don't know in the case of Sturgeon whether that's because she's a woman, but certainly wider, I do think women are just held to, I mean, just imagine you had a female prime minister who couldn't say like basic details about her personal life like some of the male politicians, it would become a massive, massive deal.
Like how many children you have, for example.
And female politicians are held to a completely different standard. And I mean, to be honest, what is wrong with looking tired? Like, you would be tired. Like, I'm tired every week. So I don't, and I'm only 31. So I don't see why a politician who's been on it the entire last 20 months or whatever wouldn't be absolutely knackered, to be honest.
See, there's the photograph as well of Boris Johnson going out for a jog in his work shirt the other day. I mean, I can only imagine what would be said if a female politician went for a wee jog and something like that. But then that's part of the thing that Boris Johnson in particular, as an example of how some male politicians can do this, but few have ever tried. He seems to have got it. Same with Donald Trump. If you create a persona, which is, I'm just a big kind of cartoonish mess, you can get away with it by you can do all those kind of things, and then still people just say, oh well, that's just him. But if you try and present yourself as a sober statesman in a perfect shirt and looking well turned out all the time, then any kind of stray from that, you get picked on. So he seems to have hit this strange little loophole where he can do that and get away with it.
This is brand. It's like if as you say, if a politician who presents him or herself as a statesman or a stateswoman goes out for a jog in a work shirt, it's going to be about, look at them, they're having a breakdown. But Johnson gets away with it because he's built this personal brand that is just where slovenliness is a virtue and people seem to like it.
Yeah.
And it's bonkers, isn't it? He's a really, really special case, and I mean that in every way possible.
I have an anecdote. I went to a drinks reception at number 10, just name dropping. That's the sort of thing that I get to do. And prior, you saw Boris come out a side door before he took this little lectern to give us a wee speech about how he used to be a journalist for 5 seconds before he became a columnist. And as he walked out, his hair was immaculate. Someone had spent time combing and gelling his hair. And as he walked to the stage, he ruffled it up. So you're absolutely spot on when we say that it is a persona that he has. And, you know, that's not to mention the fact that, you know, there's thousands of award ceremonies and speeches that he's done prior to his time at number 10 or prior to his time as a politician, where he gives the impression he's mumbling through a speech, but it turns out that he has this this act memorized. Speaking of weird things, we had some maps sent to us this week, which suggest that the boundaries are going to change across the northeast, across Dundee, across Fife, across Angus, across Perth, essentially everywhere in our area other than West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine is going to move. Now, I was the one that was doing the story, so I might just have a conversation with myself. But at any point, you guys feel free to jump in and tell me how weird it is, especially in PNG land, of which I'm not too sure. I go north of Stonehaven, well, you get confused.
The Highlands there.
The Highlands are...
The Highlands are getting redrawn too.
Getting redrid or redrawn. One of the big contentions is, of course, the Scottish Conservative leader, Douglas Ross, who's stepping down as an MP whenever the next election is. He's going to oppose the government in the vote for the redraw of the boundaries because Murray will be no more. Adele and Andy, you obviously have more expertise on Murray and Highland and how people up north will be feeling about this, but they're pretty aggrieved, I think. You know, that they'll have Highland East and Central, and then some of Murray will become part of the Gordon constituency and the rest will become Banff and Buchan. That's quite frustrating for residents in Murray who feel that they have a Murray identity, don't they?
Yes. I mean, I'm what we call up here a Toonser, which is I'm from the city of Aberdeen, so I've never lived in Murray or North or in the Highlands or anything. So I can't speak as a complete expert on how they identify and how they feel, but certainly my sense is that that Murray has its own identity. It doesn't see itself as the same as the Highlands. And so I do think people there would feel that they'd lost a kind of sense of their identity being a bit diluted, I guess. I mean, right now, I think Douglas Ross makes this point, they're represented by, it all kind of falls under Murray Council area and they're represented by the one MP, whereas now it will just be a lot more messy, I guess, because they'll have, I think, three MPs will cover different parts of Murray. So obviously the SNP in general aren't happy about the proposals because it will see Scotland lose two MPs while England gains. You might know the exact number. Is it about 11 seats?
Yeah, so England will get 10.
Yeah.
Wales will get 8. Or is it reduced by 8? They'll get 8. Northern Ireland, no change, and Scotland will lose 2. Sorry, Wales will lose 8. So England gains. And it seems that the rest of the four nations, other than Northern Ireland, will lose MPs. It does have the feel of the boundary review body or the local commission or whatever they're called. The local review body has the feel of they're redrawing maps of places they've never been to before. So, for example, Sean, now you're a St. Johnstone fan. Are you from Perth originally? Is that right?
Let's say yes for just to grease the wheels of this conversation.
Yeah, let's say that. So Scoon will now share an MP with people. Share an MP with people from Montrose, but I would entirely say that Scoon and Montrose are the same place.
No, absolutely
considering
not.
They're a fair whack away. And I know in Dundee, you'll have Dundee East and Arbroath, and I know people in Arbroath really, really dislike it when they get lumped in with Dundee because they're not Dundee, it's a different place. And it does have the feel of someone with a big red pen drawing red lines all over a map and saying, right, that makes sense, but they have sort of fumbled about with communities. Andy, you live in East Lothian. You've only got one change to face, and that's the fact that your constituency will become longer named. What's it going to be called now?
East Lothian Coast, just to confuse things. But I'm still looking at some of the bigger ones as well, because we're talking, you know, the places like Dundee and Arbroath and things like that, or the idea that Scone and Montrose are too disparate to be lumped in. Then you look further north and look at the size of the Highland North constituency, where you've got, you know, small communities that have a good view of Skye on one side and then the good folk of Wick on the other, all with one, you know, MP shuttling back and forward trying to deal with different concerns and different issues. And I mean, it's a huge landmass that they're covering there. So, you know, whichever way you kind of cut it, you know, you've either got towns and villages that feel that they have nothing to do with each other who are relatively quite close, or you've got, you know, you may as well just have an MP covering like the whole country at sometimes when you look at the scale of it. Argyll too, there's another absolute, you know, beast of a patch. So, yeah, they kind of weigh up how many people live in the area and then draw a line to try and take care of it that way. But yeah, it doesn't seem to work. And the fact that, you know, it's being redrawn to taking fewer MPs. Well, the SNP, of course, were very quick out of the marks to say that they would solve that problem by having no MPs. But I mean, that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, but it is worth pointing out, we'd lose two MPs, and regardless of how you look at it, that doesn't scream democracy to me, losing representatives. I know that we'll lose a few constituencies. Auckland and South Perthshire is one that will just be wiped off the map and split into the four different areas, including Mid-Forth Valley, which means that there will be an area of Scotland separated by the Forth, of which there's no bridge to cross over to get to it. That seems like an anomaly to me. It seems a bit odd. Did you ever hear the story about the Tsar and the reason that Trans-Siberian Railway has a little bump in it? It's because when Tsar Nicholas was drawing it, he put his finger over the end of the ruler, and the pen went over the top of the finger, and the builders of the railway were so scared to go against what the Tsar wanted that they built the bump in, even though it wasn't supposed to be there. I think that's what it seems that the Boundary Commission seemed to have done. But hopefully, there'll be people not scared of the Tsar. I don't know where I'm going with this, but there's a connection. Do you know what, listeners?
You've got to see it through,
listeners. Do you know what, you pull the two pieces of lace there together and come to your own conclusions as to what I'm getting. I think that's it for this week. Thanks to Del, Andy, Sean, and producer Chris, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, but until then, pick up or log on to the Courier, the Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe. Or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.